Chrysler talks brave, but blinks first. EVs lose their value faster than anything else on the market. And Bosch makes sure that any idiot can drive a stick.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 201 for June 21st of 2013. OPOC gets the green light from Red China. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
John, what's happening, man?
Hey, good to be here with you, man. Missed you last week. I was in Der Deutschland.
Yes.
But you guys had a pretty good show with the Lincoln designers.
Yeah, huh? It was a good show. I thought it flowed nicely and everyone had a good time.
I had a good time in Germany, but I wish I had been here for that show.
Jim and I had a good time with the ladies from Lincoln.
So. Yeah. And we got to tell everybody we got Chris Pockert from Autoblog with us tonight, too.
Hey. Great to be back.
Great to have you back.
And it was a good show with the True Believers.
Thanks.
Right. So what have you been doing, Chris, that you want to talk about?
Well, I just drove the new Fiat 500L last week on the long lead that was out in Baltimore. And it's the new bigger Cinquecento. It's not really the Cinquecento, but it's taking the brand in a new direction, trying to get more sales. And it's not a bad little vehicle. It's not my favorite thing to look at in the world, but it's incredibly spacious inside, and it'll be a good rival for the Countryman.
I've been amazed at how well Fiat's done with just the 500. It's amazing how quickly they've closed the gap with Mini. So I think maybe with the L, they might even pull even Steven with the Mini in terms of sales in the U.S. market I'm talking.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. You know, the 500 maybe was a little bit slow to get out of the gate.
Yes, it was, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, but I think as they've gotten a lot of different variants in and they've gotten the advertising message dialed in and the marketing efforts, it's come along.
What do you guys make of, speaking of Chrysler, you know, they had talked very brave about, hey, NHTSA, we're not going to recall these Jeeps because we don't see any problem with them. And then, kabam, they spun on a dime and said, yeah, we're going to recall
them. Well, I think it was an interesting thing. I think they played a little gamesmanship with NHTSA, and they just said no. And then there was like a little give and take, and then the deal they got was better. And so
they did get a better deal. You're right. I never thought of it that way.
They did get a better deal. So
it's a voluntary recall and does not involve as many vehicles.
And they said no. And NHTSA said, well, wait a minute. Nobody says no. So no. And then they talked and they got a much better deal. So it was smart.
I wonder if it was smart. I mean, it was all over the media. Everyone covered it.
Yeah, but, you know, I understand the negative PR. Oh, you can't risk that. But, you know, with such a spike gone, done,
yeah.
I don't think it's going to linger.
But, you know, I think they raised a good point. And I have not had a chance to go in and dig into the numbers myself. What they're claiming is that these Jeeps are no more prone to fires than any other kind of vehicle in its size or weight class.
Yeah.
And if that's true, and like I said, I haven't had a chance to dig into the numbers myself, they should have gone to the mat on this one. Yeah. If they said they're going to go to the mat, go to the mat. Yeah. I understand what you're saying. It was a good bargaining chip. They got a better deal. But if they were sincere about, hey, these things are no more dangerous than anything else,
well,
they should have fought it.
I think they were sincere initially, but then they determined that the PR, negative PR, might go up too high, so they decided to back off.
I wonder if it was just the PR, and if the legal department said, hey, guys, if you want to fight it, here's what the price tag is. Mm-hmm. And they went, oh, if we're going to fight it, forget it.
Fiat Chrysler should be more concerned about the, you know, the latest J.D. Power numbers.
You know,
here's the deal. I don't think it's a big deal. This initial qualities, you know, I don't buy it. The one that really matters is the one that's three.
The vehicle dependability study. That looks at 3 years of ownership.
But pretending, now that's something that if you want to pretend to fight City Hall on that, you're going to lose because, boy, the media, the mainstream media picks that up, and you know, I don't see anything breaking this J.D. Power stranglehold.
It's really remarkable. I mean, it's kind of a racket, really.
Oh, it is a racket.
To say that it's quality that's really the driver for the IQS is incorrect. I mean, it's usually design, quote-unquote, defects. And what they are things that people don't understand, whether it's, MyFord Touch or some tech system, or the fact that, their cup holder doesn't fit the right size coffee mug. Those are the things.
Yeah.
Those are the defects. It's
the
not the same thing.
The most famous one. Were the people buying Hummer H2s complaining of the gas mileage? Really?
You don't say.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, I mean, it rankles me that the J.D. Power survey has such, power with the media, because I think a lot of it's bogus.
Well, here's the other thing. General Motors leapt to the top of the list amongst, full-line manufacturers. Right. How can that be? How can you jump in 1 year like that? And part of the reason, of course, is J.D. Power redesigned its questionnaire, which has got like 250 questions on it. I mean, who fills out a 250-question questionnaire? I don't know anybody who would do that.
Somebody
but secondly,
at their cup holes.
Part of the reason why they changed that, I mean, legitimately, times change and you have to update things. But another reason is quality is getting so good right now. That if you thought Toyota was building great quality cars 10 years ago, guess what? Today, everybody's building cars to that level of defects. So they have to keep changing the survey so that you cannot compare it to years prior.
And I understand that. That makes sense to me. But the fact that it's labeled quality, to me, it's customer satisfaction. Or design stuff, put it separate.
Well, the other thing, too, is remember, this is the initial quality survey.
90
it measures
days.
90 days.
Yeah.
Come on. Everything should work for at least 90 days.
Yeah, you would hope so.
But here's why I think GM did so well in the latest one. It currently has the oldest lineup in the market. For example, the Sierra and the Silverado, which scored off the charts on this thing. They were introduced 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the longer a model stays in the market, the better the quality gets. Why? Because the guys and the gals on the line, they figure out every little bug and defect. The suppliers, same thing, figure out every little bug and defect. So the longer a vehicle has been out, almost without exception, it has very good quality. So this is a danger for GM, too, because it's coming out with so many new models this year. I think next year they're going to get killed on the IQS survey.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. Because, new models, there's always teething issues.
That's right.
How about the new Corvette performance numbers?
Pretty spectacular.
Of course, they did it with a buckboard strapped to the driver. And now the disclaimer was, I had a competition seat and this is the... They shouldn't even bother with a disclaimer. They should have said...
Just lie.
Because the new Aston Martin Volante has the same 0-60 time, 3.8.
And it's only $200,000, Peter.
Yeah, the Volante.
Yeah.
Or more.
Yeah.
I thought it was good for them.
A base VET at under 4 seconds.
Well, it wasn't the base VET. It was the...
Z51.
I
thought it was the base.
But I mean, that's a $2,500 package.
It's still
thereabouts.
It's still awesome.
It's still awesome undercuts everything else. At that money with that performance.
Yeah. What did you guys see? Several surveys came out or studies came out this week showing that EVs and plug-ins are depreciating faster than anything else on the market.
Shocked? No.
I was, actually. I thought, because up to now, at least, the Toyota Prius has been like the poster child. I mean, the stellar retained value car, although now it's starting to go down, too. But it's an older model at this point, too. But nonetheless, I was surprised to see them losing value as fast as they are.
Well, how does that work with the government incentives? Because you've got sticker prices that are way up here, and then you get the $7,500.
Great question.
Been dealt with?
Great question, Chris. So, in fact, one of our viewers sent in the exact same question, and I had to go look at the NADA, which is comparing used plug-ins to used plug-ins.
Okay.
So the government discount had nothing. Presumably to do this. They looked at what's the resale value of a plug-in in 2011, now what's the resale of it in 2012, and as long as we're doing it, let's project out to 2014. and they're depreciating faster than gasoline or diesel equivalents. Hmm. So that tells me there's, you know, a green component of the new car buying public that absolutely will pay for these cars, but there isn't enough people to backfill after that.
Right. The early adopters, they want the latest, the greatest. They're going to buy the new thing, and then there's that second tier that's not willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm driving the new Impala this week.
What's your verdict?
That's a handsome car. And like Chris mentioned, I mean, when people notice the car.
Well, Chris should tell that story.
Yeah, so I had the Impala and the loaded LTZ trim about a month ago, and I drove it down to Cleveland. So we got out of the Detroit myopia where everybody's already seen this car for months. And I was shocked at how much attention it garnered and how much positive attention and you know, various ages, demographics. I parked at a couple of restaurants with my son and just kind of watched people come up to the car. And it was really amazing. It really was. I was a little floored, actually.
Well, you know, it's classic, though. I mean, we're immersed in this stuff 24/7. And that's why I always, when I first started doing the site, I said I'd like one of the CEOs of the major Detroit car makers to move headquarters to another city for like 45 days in the summer and tell everyone it's kind of a forced vacation. But we're going to go to a city where industry executive news changes, you know, all that is like might be in the business section on page 6.
Maybe.
Not on the front page. And live in an environment where, you know, it's just, you know, we're so immersed in this. Mm-hmm. That's why when you get the Impala out on the road and people haven't seen it, they say, wow, that's great. And, you know, the other car that's having the same reaction with the general public is the Lincoln MKZ.
That thing looks sensational. Look, the rear end, it's the best rear end in the business.
Yeah.
I think,
and
right
so,
now.
You know, and then, you know, we've been hearing that, oh, well, Lincoln, you know, it's not really coming together. But, you know, the cars are just getting out into the mainstream America. And in mainstream America, they're just thinking, wow, that's pretty cool.
I saw a pearlescent white MKZ last night, and I'm telling you, the thing just pops. It just looks really good on the road.
So, yeah, I like the Impala. It's still got some of that front-wheel drive torque steer thing going on, but there's no question that it's a whole nother dimension for Impala.
Mm-hmm.
So wish him the best with it.
Hey, I got to tell you, as you guys know, I was not here last week because I was out at Bosch seeing everything. Boy, they opened up a lot of cool stuff. But one that I wanted to talk about is they're coming out with what they call the E-Clutch. So it's for manual transmissions. They don't touch the transmission. All they do is have an electronically controlled clutch. So it doesn't matter how bad you are with the gas and trying to modulate the clutch pedal, every time it will shift perfectly. And what they're really going for is in emerging markets. They cited India in particular, where there's not a car culture, really, and people are getting into automobiles for the first time in their lives. You can have a manual transmission, and you'll drive as well as anybody who's really good at it, including going up steep hills and starting from a dead stop on a steep hill.
Do you still shift?
You still shift, but if you're in first gear, you can bring it to a complete stop without doing anything. Just press on the brake. Don't press in the clutch pedal at all, and then just step on the gas, and it'll accelerate away.
Wow.
But then you have to start shifting again.
So that's effectively a switch then. I mean,
it's a switch, right.
Couldn't they just take that out of the control of the drivers and lose the pedal and just have people swapping gears? It seems like an interesting idea, but it seems logical. It seems like an intermediary step. I mean, it's kind of a fun idea.
There goes the rite of passage of teaching kids how to drive stick.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what it does is it... you know, look, in emerging markets, they like to go with manual transmissions. And not just emerging, you know. In Europe, it's still a big thing, although they've learned how to shift on their own there. Nonetheless, you know, manuals are cheaper. You know, India especially wants lower-cost cars. So it's a way of keeping the cost low, but making it so just about anybody can drive a manual transmission. And if you're driving along and you back off the gas, it disengages the engine, so you're freewheeling. So there's a fuel efficiency aspect to it as well. I just thought it was a cool little technology. I'd not heard anybody working on this before.
So what else did you do over there?
Oh, God. They had so much other stuff out there. They had the hydraulic hybrid that they're working on with Peugeot. They wouldn't let us drive it. but they said it can be as efficient as a battery electric hybrid, i.e. get as good a fuel efficiency, but at far lower cost, far lower weight. And they said they've got prototypes running around, but they would not let us drive them because Peugeot said, nobody in the media gets into this. So my question to them was, well, what about the noise? Because I've driven other hydraulic hybrids, and they're unacceptably noisy. Even though they work just fine, they're noisy. And they said, yeah, we've solved the noise issue. But they wouldn't explain how or what they did. So I'm dying to get into that one. Peugeot says it'll be showroom ready in 2016. The Bosch guys were not so committed to 2016. They just kept saying that's what Peugeot says. So that was kind of cool, too.
Interesting. 24-hour Le Mans is this weekend.
Yeah, I was there last year. One of the most awesome
nothing
experiences.
Like
one of the top 10 experiences of my life going
to
that.
Nothing like it.
But no Delta Wing this year.
No, and Audi, unless the script has changed in the middle of the night, Audi is going to go 1, 2, 3. I mean, Toyotas can put together a couple fast laps, but they can't do it over time. So next year, everything changes with the intramural battle, to end all battles between Porsche and Audi. And even though the Porsche looks like might be the same, it isn't underneath from what my moles are telling me. It's got radical stuff underneath it.
The current Porsche?
No, the one that's coming in 2014.
Well, as you've talked about before, it's amazing that Volkswagen Group will let these two brands that it owns slug it out and spend a fortune doing it.
Yeah, for an MPX, so go have at it, boys.
I love that, and they do that with their products too, right? I mean, you've got Audis with the R8s, and you've got Lamborghinis, and they're all like kind of in the same, you know.
So, you know, Audi has spent $100 million a year for 12 years on this program.
But a key reason, too, which I learned at the SAE motor racing panel that I moderated a few months back, was that Audi's racing budget is part of its R&D budget, not part of marketing.
That's how the Germans do it, and that's why, you know, PX said, yeah, go do it, you know? And so that's going to be really interesting.
That's smart. That's a completely different mindset, I would imagine, when you do it that way, right? I mean, you're not just looking at it in the short term. You don't want to just get the headlines this year because you're going back to Le Mans or whatever it is, or you won again. You know, you've got an investment in it for the long haul, and it's just a different mindset.
Completely, and you nailed it. It's not for short-term results. The results better be there, or heads will roll, but nonetheless, you're right, they're in it for the long haul. And I love that attitude that racing it's part of R&D. You know, the two are inseparable.
It's part of what they do.
And do they cycle engineers in and out of those programs?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, see, that's brilliant.
Yes, they do. I mean, Honda pioneered that in the 60s with their Formula One program.
Right.
They just decided that's how they would train their engineers, which they did. And, you know, then the media guys were stumbling around at a preview in 1970-something, and there was this guy who was running the Formula One program was standing next to the Civic. What are you doing here? That's what I do. But, yeah, they pioneered that, and now everybody does it.
Well, you know, there's an old quote I would love to dig up the original source on. I don't even know if it's true, but I've been using it, so I'll continue to use it. But supposedly Soichiro Honda was asked one time, how do you get so much work out of your engineering force? And he said, you hire young engineers, and you push them to the breaking point, and you just hold them there. I've never been able to find a source that verifies he actually said that, but it sounds like it might be true, because he is known to have hit engineers on the head with a hammer to get their attention. Now, you know, all the Japanese, they wear their little helmets in the factory and all that, so he wasn't bashing somebody's brains in, but you know, I'm sure the guy got his bell rung nonetheless. Hey, why don't we take a quick break here, commercial break, and why don't we get our guest Don Runkle on? So, Carmen, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. Don Ruckel, welcome back to AutoLine After Hours.
Thanks a lot. It's been a little while since I've been here.
Yeah.
He was here a couple of years ago, I guess. Yeah.
Speaking of someone who's a young engineer once.
Yeah, that's right.
It's interesting you were talking about Honda, and when I visited their R&D center when I was head of engineering at GM, or advanced engineering, Kalmoda was had me over there. And I asked him this question about how he views engineers. And he says, we hire them when they're about 20. We keep them in engineering until they're 40, until they want to have a family and stuff. And then we ship them to the suppliers. He says, for that 20 years, he says, because for the first 10 years, from 20 to 30, they don't really know anything. So they're there to learn from the guys that are now 30 to 40. Then we get the real productivity out of them from 30 to 40. And then they want to do other things than make cars. So, again, I don't know if that's how they actually did it, but I did check their average age in Honda R&D, and at that time they had about 8,000 engineers, and it was remarkably 30 years old.
Yeah.
20 to 30 plus 30 to 40.
Well, you know, I love how they cycle their engineers through all different aspects of the company.
Yeah.
So I was down in Marysville, Ohio. This is, you know, years ago, back in the 90s. And one of the F1 guys was in charge of the stamping operation there.
Yeah.
And to speed up their transfer presses, he put in carbon fiber transfer arms just so it could run faster. And they got, I don't know, one or two strokes a minute more out of the press.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how they infuse it throughout the company.
They were one of the first to really put card-carrying production engineers into their racing program for just about 2 years, because when I met with him, I tried to start doing that, you know, as chief engineer of Chevrolet, and because we had our racing group, and again, it was out of the R&D budget, like you said, we didn't run that out of sales and marketing, it came out of engineering, so to speak, but most of the people in there were inoculated but died of the disease. They stayed in engineering. They stayed in racing. And we tried to move a few in and out, but it was nothing internalized like Honda did. Honda was the best at that.
Were you involved in any of the Chevy stuff that was all under the table when Paul Van Valkenburg was there and they were giving stuff to Jim Hall's racing team and all that?
I mean, I was there. Herb Fischel, who used to work for, Vince Piggins, the mastermind under the table.
Very early in my career.
So Vince was there when I was there as a startup sort of engineer. And then Herb took over from Vince.
Right.
And then he was floating around. But it was actually the way I decided to come to the car business in that is I was wrenching for my cousin in central Pennsylvania on dirt track cars. Hmm. And we ran Ford engines at the time. And every once in a while, a engine in a crate would show up. Detroit, Dearborn, actually. And so we'd take the engine out, put it in the car, and it was wicked, just wicked. And we could never sort of figure that out. And so when I got and was Herb's boss, I said, Herb, do you guys ever send engines to backwoods dirt tractors? He says, yeah. He says, we used to put those out to Stars. And my cousin at the time, Mitch Smith, was the hot dog in that central Pennsylvania. Chris Economaki used to always brag about Mitch Smith, you know. And he was the big guys would come into central Pennsylvania, Sealings Grove and Williams Grove, the big guys being Unser, AJ, and those guys come in and dirt track. Mitch would always beat them.
Really?
But he never had this a vision to go out and do what they do on the big tracks and, you know, do that sort of stuff. But the crate engines, and then I said, I got to figure out how to get out there. That sounds like the right place.
That's what got you into the car business.
That's what got
me into that. I never knew
that. I was sort of I liked working on mechanical stuff. But it was through that little episode that I finally decided that, you know, mechanical engineering and University of Michigan and that sort of stuff, and ended up working at Ford for 3 years.
No, I never knew you worked at Ford.
Yeah, I worked at Ford until it came time to graduate from.
You had to retire from GM and all to admit that, huh?
No, I started at Eastman Kodak for a short time as a co-op. I was at a co-op, And then got recruited in Ford and had a fabulous looking resume because it was all this Ford stuff. And Ford was just a fabulous place to learn stuff. Lincoln Mercury sales office, operations research, the research labs, all that. And then it came time to, you know, get your normal job, and Chevy outbid Ford. So I ended up going to Chevy.
No kidding. I didn't know that part of your background. That's awesome.
But it's crate engines from the under-the-table guys. What the hell is this? I don't know, but it's a lot more than what we have right now.
And now you got a totally different kind of engine.
Yeah, totally different. So
we, you know, obviously our viewers will remember that we had Peter Hofbauer on 3 years ago or something like
that.
Yeah,
it's been about that time.
And then we've had you on in the past, too.
Yeah,
and
I think I was on just a little bit before that, and when I joined Eco Motors, actually.
Yeah, and now you guys got a production partner.
Yeah, we have lots happened over the last year since Peter was on the show, but probably the big headline over the last couple months was the signing of a conglomerate, recent midsize in China, Zhongding. And they've committed to build a production plant in the Anhui province, which is sort of west of Shanghai, a couple hours, and put the OPOC into production. And so that was a couple $100 million.
So it's a serious effort.
So that's a serious effort. They have about 60 engineers working. If you'd walk through their CAD terminals in Shanghai, you'd see OPOC engines up there and stuff. So it's that. And part of that deal, we get... we negotiated a certain percentage of their capacity for our use. Those engines would
That's an intriguing negotiation.
Because when you're a startup company, you never have any money. You're always trying to figure out how to do this, and the engine business is a fairly high CapEx. You know, you need a couple $100 million, $300 million bucks to put a line of engines in. So how do you do that? Because nobody's going to actually give you that money and try that. So we negotiated as part of the royalty stream a slight reduction in that for them in exchange for a significant capacity of engines that they would supply to us. Now, we need to sell those to people. Gensets are sort of the first idea here.
And, electric generators.
Yeah, because they all have engines. And the nice thing about those sort of things is most generators are buyers of engines, and most genset companies. Generac is an example, and other companies.
They don't make their own engines.
In general. Some don't do, like Cummins, of course, with Onan, but they still buy a lot of engines. Still buy John Deere, Iveco, Cummins, Chevrolet, GM, you know, depending on what the thing is.
Honda.
So at least they're interested in, yeah, on the smaller side. So they need my briefcase there. So it's, again, how do you get revenue as opposed to just a license, a royalty stream? How do you get revenue without having any CapEx, you know, without having the $200 million yourself? So and it helps them because it gives them more volume. We're sort of a sales team for their plant, right? We're out looking for engines they supply to us. So it's a very good thing for them also.
How's the sales going on your side?
Well, we're not selling yet. I mean, you know, we closed our Series C mid last year. We're still looking.
What's that mean, Series C?
In venture capitals, the first round of investment is normally thought of as Series A, so a certain amount of money. Coastal led that and did that. Bill Gates, as you know, led the Series B, which was the next round of investment, which I think is approximately when Peter was on. Mm-hmm. Must have been mid 10, something like that.
Yeah, right.
So you spend all that money, hopefully move the product ahead. Then we did a Series C, and Bremer Energy Ventures out of New York led that, and Gates and Kosla put in their fair share, so to speak, of that. So we just went through that to get – you typically raise enough money to sort of get through the next, you know, 18 months, something like that. Hopefully in that time you've created a value proposition because you may need to raise Series D, E, like – Fisker went through FG.
I was just going to say, ask Fisker.
You might not want to mention Fisker right now.
$1.2 billion later, and Tesla did the same sort of thing. I think they went through Series E or something like that, and then went public. That's the final series, so to speak. Mm. So we did that, and then we signed a number of other LOIs, letters of intent, so that we're going to talk, and this is where you're headed. With, again, three Chinese companies. We have to convert those into something, a development agreement, a license agreement, something like that. So that's work to be done yet. John Ding is the way we started that, with a letter of intent, and said this is what we'd like to do together, and then a contract to help co-develop, and then finally a license agreement and a strategic agreement that we got some of. The reason is more than just a license is because we get some of the capacity for that. And so we have three other Chinese companies. Two are in the top 10, so I can't go through their names because we have a deal to not to at this point.
OEMs, you're saying? Positive.
OEMs, yeah.
Car companies.
Yeah.
So we're seeing the graphic up there. Maybe we should remind the viewers what the deal is with this
motor. Technology.
Yeah, I mean, lighter, fewer moving parts, more powerful, more compact.
It's basically a different architecture. So today, if you drove to work or whatever, you drove a four-stroke engine, period. And you've been doing that for 100 years.
Right.
Because it's the best. It has the best combination of fuel economy, emissions, reliability, power, all those things. And it became the champion because it had all those features better than steam and electric vehicles, which we were driving in the early 1900s. And it has maintained that leadership and championship role. And there's been lots of tries, right? The rotary came and went. The electrics, I think we're on about our third shot right now to try to do it. I mean, we did the Chevette electric, then we did the Impact that led to the EV1, and now we got the Bolt and the other ones out there, and the other companies are doing the same. So the four-stroke is up there. So ours is an architectural change. It has opposed pistons. So our pistons applaud versus pounding their fist against the ceiling, so to speak. And that architecture, and we have a single crankshaft, so virtually all opposed piston engines normally have at least two cranks, one over here and one over here if it's designed that. Sometimes there's three, another one up here, and they get more opposed pistons. Ours has a single crank, so that lends itself well to transmissions and all that sort of stuff. So our patents are all tied up, and how do you get these outer pistons to connect to this inner crankshaft? And opposed piston engines have a fundamental advantage in surface-to-volume ratio, so they have a little bit of an advantage on thermal efficiency. And because our pistons come together over that same stroke, our pistons are actually traveling at half the speed of a normal one, which has to travel that roughly same stroke. So at the same RPM of crankshaft output, our pistons are loafing. So we basically have about half the, and most of the friction of an engine comes from the pistons, obviously. You're scraping rings against cylinders and stuff like that. Now, we only have two main bearings, four cylinders. It would be like this. We'd have five main bearings. So there's other odds and ends. We don't have a camshaft, no cam bearings, no valve train, no none of those. So from that standpoint, it's a two-stroke because our gas exchange relies on porting and that. So again, it's the balance is very good, which leads, you saw one of the pictures there where we have two of these, what we call a dual module, and we can turn off basically half the engine. So
cylinder deactivation, so
yeah,
to speak.
Yeah, but it's engine deactivation. So in cylinder deactivation, which we've had for many years, I mean, Cadillac was sort of the first one out there, but since then things have gotten a lot better because we didn't quite have the computer power and the injectors, and it wasn't actually direct injections. There's a lot of things.
In other words, they work today.
they're terrific today. But again, the pistons are still moving, so you still have, you don't have all the friction because you're not loading that piston, but you still have some. So I don't know what the quotes are today, but probably 6 or 7% improvement in fuel economy. It's not too expensive. You're deactivating the cylinder. It's a good thing to do.
What does it sound like?
So it gets something like that. In our case, in the dual module, like shown on the screen right now, when you don't need, let's say this is a 400 horsepower module for us guys that like 400 horsepower, we'd put two 200 horsepower modules in there. And way over 80% of the time, when you're driving, the car I have has 400 horsepower, probably 90% of the time, I'm using less than 200. You're usually using 50, 60, something like that. Mm-hmm. So the second engine wouldn't come on. So think of it as a plug-in hybrid where the motor doesn't start because you got enough juice in the electric. So it's just a dual motor hybrid, so to speak. And so that feature is modular displacement. because you bring on more displacement when you need it. And that's worth normally, and the EPA has always been beating over the heads of Detroit, why don't you do modular displacement? It's worth about 30% fuel economy improvement on city and highway cycles. And the reason is we didn't know how to do it. We know that it was a good idea, but you can't do it with 2 4-cylinder engines or 2 flat boxer BMW motorcycle engines. The balance will be off, the firing order screwed up. You can't do it with V6s or V8s. So, but this one, when you have a balanced opposed piston engine, it is balanced, and it's balanced when they're both running. It's balanced when only one's running, and the firing order sounds right. It sounds like a 4-cylinder when you have it one running. It sounds like an 8-cylinder when you have them.
It does both. Sound like an 8 when you...
Yeah, I mean, it's going to fire, you know, like a more or less an 8-cylinder engine at the same crankshaft RPM.
But, I mean, the exhaust notes would, it's not going to sound ring-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a
yeah,
like other things.
You know, we have to, we've had, since the time we came on, we have got a lot of good test data, still stuff to do, but on emissions, efficiency, and power, you know, I like the numbers we're seeing. We still aren't getting what we deserve from the architecture, but we're down the path. So that looks like the architecture is showing up. At least John Ding thinks it's showing up, and a couple other guys think it is.
And this can run on both diesel and gasoline?
And since the time we when Peter was on here, then we only had diesels running. Since that time, we made a gasoline OPOC because there's always an issue with two-stroke engines. Will they run? Will they idle? And B, will you be able to run a three-way catalytic converter behind them? Because they, quite frankly, pass a lot of air through the exhaust, and you end up without a stoichiometric air-fuel ratio in front of a three-way catalyst. And we don't want to invent a new after-treatment because three-ways have given us 600-horsepower Corvettes, and, I mean, the catalyst is just fabulous. So we want to just use that. So we wanted to demonstrate, because there's a few skeptics, obviously, that says, can you make it run on a three-way catalyst with gasoline? So we built an engine. We didn't run the power and all the other stuff, but we were interested in low. Can you run it at a couple kilowatts of power and idle and stuff like that? And we ran enough to sufficiently prove, because of our, we have an electric turbo in this also. We don't always have to have it. On the diesel, we don't have to have it. On the gas, we do.
For scavenging?
For scavenging, right. Because part of this is, you know, on a 4-stroke engine, basically the scavenging is you use up 2 of the strokes, the intake and the exhaust. They do nothing other than get the bad gas out and the good gas in. We got to get that all done in 2 strokes, so we don't waste the other 2. So our engine fires every time there's an expansion stroke, every time they come together, where a 4-stroke does it every other time, and they use the intake and the exhaust stroke as their gas exchange, plus a bunch of valves and camshafts and all that stuff. That's all there to get the fresh air, to get the mixture right and the emissions met.
Where'd you get the electric turbo?
We invented it ourselves.
I was going to say, I'm not aware of any on the market.
We've looked lots of places, and we still have people in there. We're talking to a couple potential people. We'd like them to build it because electric turbos work on 4-stroke engines. And we're trying to show the merits of, obviously, they have virtually no lag. You don't need a variable vane turbo if you have electric because you have that way to control the turbo. So we built a 2.5 kilowatt. We built a 5 kilowatt. That's a pretty stout turbo. First, 300-horsepower engine. I mean, that's it. So we built that, and now we're talking to a number of people that are in the turbo business to say, wouldn't you like to consider this? And we have some intellectual property around that, so we're willing to, you know, license it and so forth. Mostly what we're interested in is getting a turbo for us and our customers to be able to use. But it's part of the solution, particularly on gasoline, on the scavenging efficiency. Because we need scavenging efficiency. Scavenging efficiency is sort of a number of how well did you clean out the combustion chamber after the combustion occurs? And we need to be up there in the 90%+. Normally, 2 strokes are about 65%, and that's why they don't hit emission numbers. So we have to do that, the electric turbo, the circumferential ports, the asymmetrical timing of the piston. So a lot of the architecture gives us that, and the ECT also is part of that equation.
Does it have particular power delivery characteristics? I mean, is it, you know, high revving, or is it torque rich down low without a turbo? Or
it's torque rich down low because ours will always have a turbo, or a super on the diesel could get by with maybe either only a supercharger or only a turbocharger. It depends what the application is. For a gen set, you want to run it at 1800 RPM, 60 cycles, and you might be able to do that with a fairly elementary a boosting system, where when you need transient response, trucks, cars, stuff like that, you're going to have a more sophisticated boosting. We can do that with a turbo plus a supercharger, which is what we got running right now in the ZD engine, or we could do it just with an electric turbo. But in general, our test numbers show that it's pretty stout on torque at the lower RPM. So that's what the truckers are always interested in. It's up there in the range you would want to see, so to speak, on the power curves. It tends to want to rev a little higher because we can. We have pistons that are running half the speed, but we don't run it at twice. So it's not, you know, if you pulled your power at, let's say, 2,000 RPM, we're not running it at 4,000 to pull that power. So we run it a little faster, but we don't need to push that envelope because we want the friction advantages of slower running pistons.
Is that something you could mount vertically in a bike, perhaps?
You could. Haven't thought about, you know, that, but because of its, we'd have to do something because we have a conventional oil pan. We do not run the exhaust gas like a loop scavenged, like your weed whacker, so to speak. So it's not that type of a two-stroke. We have an oil pan. The oil is separated. Just like, from that standpoint, it's like a four-stroke. We have a positive crankcase ventilation, drain back, all that stuff. So you wouldn't. Now, if we ran a dry sump, then you could. And the initial engines we ran, and this engine started with a DARPA contract for aerospace, for high-performance aerospace program because of its power density.
Drones, it sounds like.
It was drones at that
time. No kidding.
Right, this was some time ago. But they were looking for this combination of performance but fuel economy because they want to go up there and park for a while and watch things, I guess. And so they needed the weight of the engine and the weight of the fuel to be at a low level. And this turned out to be the best alternative, including the gas turbine.
Since you've signed this contract with Tianjin, is it bringing others out of the woodwork saying, oh, if you're going to put it in production, now we want to talk?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the conversations are productive so far. We have another deal we're trying to move along here with one of these guys. We have a lot of work yet to do. We have now kicked off the production design because there's a lot of things. Once you are pretty confident the emissions can be done and that you're on the right path for efficiency, fuel economy, and that you've pulled the power, then you work on the durability and the manufacturability. Do you have tool access and all those things? So we're now hard over on the productionization. Not to say that everything else is, you know, feet up in the desk and this will all be there. So we got our.
So you started with diesel. Does that mean that you're looking more toward the commercial end of things to begin with in terms of vehicles?
It's a great question, Chris. I think we started with diesel because the DARPA contract wanted to run on JP8, and that's sort of like diesel. And so there it was.
You go where the money is. Right.
You go where the money. And at the end of the day, the diesel cycle is fundamentally more efficient by, you know, 20-25%, not just like four strokes. So if you're trying to shoot the lights out on fuel economy, you would go with diesel, so to speak. But then there's a lot of interest and a lot of people that want gasoline for lots of good reasons. So we want to make sure that we can do the after treatment with gasoline. And then on the after treatment for diesel would be we want to use conventional after treatment. So depending on the emission law, whether it's a particulate trap, selective catalyst reduction, those sort of things, oxidizing catalyst. So we want to stick with. We want to be not too inventive on the after-treatment world. We'd like to just be able to make sure the engine-out emissions, this is without any after-treatment, are clean enough that if you stick that emissions into conventional aftertreatment, whether it be conventional three-way catalyst for gasoline or selective catalyst reduction for diesel, that the tailpipe emissions are at the right levels.
That's cool. Hey, we've got a lot of questions coming in from the audience. Why don't we get to rapid fire? So, Carmen, let it rip. Okay, Brian says, question for Don. Are there racing applications for the EcoMotor engine? And he also asked about motorcycles, too. But what about racing? Wouldn't that be a great way to get the message out?
Yeah, as you know, we did a lot of engine development at Roush. So when Jack saw this, he says, why the hell didn't I think of this? And then we showed it to Robert Yates. And he says, this is a great, great racing engine. When can we do this? Now, I'm sure there'll be a rule. You can't race two strokes or something like that.
Well, I mean, IndyCar needs a third manufacturer.
Yeah.
They have GM, Honda, but Honda's going to Formula One in 2015, so I think there's danger that Honda might pull out, so... Yeah. I think you guys should do an Indy engine.
But my old buddy Roger Penske always said the way to make a small fortune is start with a large one and race. So yeah, having run Chevy's racing, not run it, but it reported to me for a long time, and having had Buick racing for a long time, it's I love it. So you don't have to. This is an easy pitch for me. I have to hold back because it does cost a lot of money and. And so maybe in our future at some point, but not right now. Or marine racing types of applications.
Oh, yeah, sure.
A good marine would be a good. It's a flat, low engine. The dual module in marine, you know, you always want to get out of the hole, get on plane, and then you need less than half the power you really have. So that second engine just goes to sleep and you cruise for the next 6 hours. So.
Right Knight wants to know, what's the peak RPM on the engine?
I'd say on the diesel, I don't know the answer to that yet, but we've been running up into the 3,800 RPM, sort of 4,000 RPM range. We want to try to get as much power as we can at the lower RPMs, just to not use up our friction advantage there. There is a thing there because you got to get this gas exchange done quickly because a four-stroke has these extra two strokes in there. We got to get it done between bang. The exhaust port opens, so that's the beginning of it. So this high-pressure gas starts to go out. Then we open an intake port and try to chase the exhaust out. Then we close the exhaust port, and the intake is still open. And so now we have a turbocharger. We boost it, so we have variable compression ratio done the right way, not with a bunch of claptrap mechanical. Then you close everything. Now you're into just a combustion or a compression cycle. So that may limit the ultimate RPM because that's a lot of stuff to get done.
Yeah, no kidding. Jay Cujo wants to know, what's the best kind of metal to make this engine out of?
We don't care about it, obviously. It'll depend totally on the application. When we were working on aerospace applications, and we put two of these in a EADS Eurocopter for the 2010 Berlin Air Show. It was not a running copter, but they wanted to show... we put 200-300 horsepower OPOX because they wanted 600 horsepower takeoff, cruise at 300, and do that. And so in those applications, you would put titanium rods. The engine would love magnesium blocks because a subtlety of the design is four-stroke engines, boxer engines, those types of engines. 90% of the loads from the combustion forces go through the crank into the crank case. Ours stay in the crank, so it never goes into the crankcase. That's why you can why you only need two main bearings. So that means your crankcase can basically be a lot lighter weight and less robust. And so magnesium would be a terrific application for, let's say, a marine. You still got to pay for the material. The one we're doing with John Ding is compacted graphite iron, so cast iron, so to speak. We've done aluminum monoblocks. Our generation 4, 5, and 6 were all monoblock aluminum. So we don't care on the material at all. That'll come down to a cost, weight, application trade-off. The aerospace guys will go light. The commercial guys will go
low cast
cost. Iron, low cost. And
So, that's right. Chris, I got one for you because we were talking about this before the show started, but John Manoogian II has called in to say or written in, whatever happened at Audi with the firing of Wolfgang Dürheimer, the head of R&D?
Oh, you know, that's interesting. We were just talking about that, and that appears to have just gone down today, and I think kind of a shock. Nobody really knows exactly what happened.
And you were saying you think he's about 55 years old.
I think his birthday is today, so happy birthday is what I read. And, you know, he came over having done Porsche and really ushered in a new era of profitability for that company. You know, he pushed through the Cayenne, and then they gave him, you know, Bentley and Bugatti to be in charge of, and he was viewed as one of the rising stars. And there's all sorts of rumors going on right now that he was a little reluctant to push through the e-tron stuff into production, the R8, the A3. And that wasn't going over real well with Martin Winterkorn, and maybe they didn't see eye to eye on that and styling and some other things. So he might have just broomed him out, which is kind of interesting considering, you know, for a while there, he was considered to be one of those people that might eventually replace him.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure we'll learn more in the days or weeks to come. Peter, I got one for you here. Even Steven from the UK says, with Audi having great success in Le Mans with their diesel R18 and 50% of Europe driving diesels, when do you think Americans and U.S. automakers will embrace modern diesels?
Oh, I don't know, John. We've talked about this since day one of the show. I mean, I don't know why they don't, but I don't see it growing like leaps and bounds. Maybe it will. What do you think?
It seems like it just comes down to performance and numbers and stuff like that. I mean, the modern diesels are
Great, yeah.
I mean, they're not noisy, they're not stinky, they're not rough, they're not any of those things. They're great.
Just lots of torque and great
torque
fuel efficiency.
And in America, what are you looking for? Lots of torque. That's why we had big engines.
Well, I'll say this, apropos of my visit to Bosch last week. Next year, Europe goes to Euro 6 emission standards. Mm-hmm. That brings them almost even, Steven, with the Tier 2 Bin 5 EPA standards. Ergo, Europe now has to use all the emission standards we've been using, or emissions equipment. Well, that's going to have enormous scale, enormous manufacturing volume, which is going to bring down the cost over here for diesels. Yeah. And Bosch is predicting that diesel sales by, was it 2015? No, probably 2016. They're saying like 10% of the U.S. market could go diesel. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty optimistic.
Three times the hybrid take rate.
That's optimistic to me.
Yeah.
You think?
Yeah.
We shall, now, what they're also including, I'm sure, in that number, the heavy-duty pickups with diesel engines in them, too. Mm-hmm. But I think that's
a fair
account.
A little bit also where the manufacturers probably come out in terms of trying to get to 54.5 miles per gallon. Diesel would be a big step.
Yeah, if we start
the single biggest step you could do, other than our engine, of course.
The light duties with the V6, diesel V6s, you know, in the 1500s and all of that, you could see a lot more volume that way.
Right.
But I think we need to get the cost of diesel under control, you know, as a fuel. You know, we have the quality of the fuel is all over the place. That's one of the things that the engineers talk about all the time. The cetane ratings in America are all over the map, and that's like the octane rating. And the fuel quality isn't necessarily there consistently across the country, so you have to kind of dumb down your engine tuning when you come over to America. And then you've got the cost of fuel that's higher than gas, you know, in most places, and that's makes it really, really hard because Americans, you know, we look at how much do I spend at the pump.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily look at the number of how many miles per gallon. We want to know how often am I going to the pump and how much am I shelling out every time I do it.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, the you know, diesel cracks before gasoline does, so it's probably a refinery balance issue more than anything. Now, I'm not a little old on where sulfur comes into that. Does that, taking sulfur out of diesel, bring the cost up from a conceptual
It does, but sulfur's got to come out of gasoline now, too, to have direct injection. So
diesel has, you know, about 10% more energy than a gallon of gasoline. So when you buy that, you got 10% more there, and then the engine itself is about 20. So there's where the 30 comes from.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're kind of entering an era where people are more comfortable with different ideas of what powers their car, right? Okay. I mean, you were talking about steam power in the early 1900s, and we haven't been in an era like that in terms of powertrain diversity you know, since that time, and now we've got it. We've got pure electrics. We've got hybrids. We've got diesel hybrids. Yeah. You know, people talking about fuel cells and all that. We've got OPOC.
Yeah, and all gets sorted out on cost benefit and all that yeah. sort of stuff. The four-stroke has met those challenges for a long, long time because at the end of the day, it had the right balance of stuff. It did all those things in total better. So it deserves to be the king, so, so to speak.
In fact, this is a good segue for the next question. Eric Ambrose wants to know, as an engineer, he says, I have thought of a few crazy engine designs. Will Eco Motors' success open a Pandora's box and bring new engine architectures to the market?
Could be. I mean, you never know. There's lots of, there's about, I don't know, 15. We try to track as many as we can what their technology is, an advanced engine types of companies. Some of them are opposed pistons. They can't do our single crank because that's all patented. But
in fact, we had a Katie's Power here 4 months ago or something like that.
And they had an architecture that was very novel at the beginning. They've abandoned that, and they basically now have a what I'd call a Yonkers architecture, a dual crankshaft type of thing like the 1937 Yonkers. But they've done great work, I think. You know, I've talked to Jones and on combustion development and stuff like that. They see the advantages of thermal efficiency that you get with opposed pistons. And so I think the answer is you might see other ones, and it might be bad for us, but what the hell, that's what you're always trying to do.
I think it would only help you guys because it validates that there's other ideas out there that work.
I know my founder and the inventor of the engine, Peter Huffbauer, hates Acadies. I said, the best thing that could happen to us is a Katie's successful. There's more than one, you know, there's lots of four-stroke engines out there, and they all seem to be doing fine. So let's invite other people that are taking have maybe a different approach, but using some of the concepts, not all of ours, but some of them.
Dave Arnoldson, I heard you talking about getting a crate engine every now and then with your cousin. He says, will Eco Motors offer crate engines to upgrade older cars, trucks, or maybe motorcycles?
Yeah, it's not in the plan right now, but again, that's all those things are possible in the future. We've got to get production design done, tidy up continue the technical challenges, get ZD off and running, sign another customer or two, something like that. Then you can... Then you can do some of the other things.
Right.
I have a couple of donors for you when you get on that program.
Let's see.
Peter always says two of these will fit in this Porsche pretty good. So.
Ed in St. Louis, and this is directed at me, he says, hey, John, you said GM's coming out with 20 new models this year. What are they? So Sierra, Silverado, Impala, Cadillac ELR, Cadillac CTS. Help me out, these
Cruise
guys.
Cruise Diesel is
Cruise Diesel.
ATS.
Well, the ATS was out last year.
Yeah. But we'll probably see the V, right?
Yes. Will we see the V this year? Okay, the V. New Enclave?
I think we're going to get something in the middle.
There was new Escalade.
There was talk about like the Anthem or something in the middle that's between the Encore and the Enclave.
Aren't they tuning up the Malibu too? But that's not.
Oh yeah, yeah. Refresh of the Malibu. That's right.
It's not new, but it's a lot of change in there. A lot of improvement.
I don't know, Ed. I think we got up to 10.
New Corvette.
Oh yeah, new Corvette.
Jeez, that old thing.
Right.
Tahoe, Yukon.
Right.
Yeah.
And more. Believe me, they say 20, and I'm believing them when they say 20.
Spark EV.
They wouldn't kid you on that number.
VRM Chris, I'm going to throw... it says, question for Peter. Are you disappointed in the C7 because of the greenhouse?
I think that the C7 is a great car. I love the convertible. I am disappointed in the design of the greenhouse. We covered that in last Thursday's show.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we actually, Ben, juxtaposed the C7 coupe against the Nissan GTR and went back and forth. And
they're pretty close.
Yeah. Just disappointing.
Youngblood in Cleveland says, hey, Mr. Mack, at your visit to Germany's Bosch facility, is there anything that you are allowed to talk about that took your breath away? Boy, they showed us at least 10 different technologies. I'm not going to say that they all took my breath away, but I love the hydraulic hybrid. I love that that electronic clutch. A lot of autonomous stuff, semi-autonomous, more autonomous, fully autonomous. That's coming on like gangbusters. I wouldn't say anything that took my breath away, but it just a lot of cool stuff. Just good, good.
Did they have any range stuff on the hydraulic hybrid?
No.
Because hydraulic is a great power.
A lot of torque.
But thin on energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the round trip efficiency, I buy the idea much better than electric. Cost should be lower.
They said you can recoup.
Boku torque, a Boku recovery, much more than a battery can.
You can recapture or capture so much more of your braking energy.
Because it's, from that standpoint, it's like a capacitor. You can hammer this thing. Where a battery, at some point, you just can't handle anymore. So, you know, unless the battery gets too big. Mm-hmm. But the issue, aside from the noise, I assume they work that, is to get the range. Mm-hmm. Now, it would be good for, like, a postal delivery vehicle.
Sure.
You know.
Garbage trucks,
things like that. Short stop.
Fixed routes.
Engine runs, stuff like that, so that you have a lot of stop-start. But let's drive from here to Muskegon. You know, that's you just run out of energy really fast, unless they have some innovation there, because you're going to store all this in some sort of compressed nitrogen, or that's where the energy goes.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I don't know what theirs is, but
no, it's both hydraulic and nitrogen.
Yeah,
and they use hydraulic power to compress the nitrogen. Yeah, you know this stuff, Don. You got it.
So I have to ask about the e-clutch again. I mean, is that something you mentioned? Emerging markets like India, is that something that they hinted that other suppliers, like for the U.S. and for Europe, are looking at the, you know, instituting them and trying to recapture a little bit of...
You know, I don't think it would come to the U.S. only because 90% plus of all vehicles sold in the U.S. are automatics. And, you know, there seems to be much more interest in going with dual clutch transmissions, mm-hmm. and even in Europe, mm-hmm. than, you know, propagating the manual transmission. So
and they think they got the cost at a point where it would be a good play to keep manual, a little trick on the clutch.
Right.
But not chase you into the cost of an automatic.
Exactly.
But get fuel efficiency.
And they said, it's a clutch pedal assembly, so you can just tweak the spring in it to give it the clutch feel that you want.
Yeah.
But it's all handled electronically. So they said it's actually quite low cost.
Mm-hmm. Good.
They didn't share the numbers with me, but I believe them.
Obviously, that's what they would be trying to do, especially if it's emerging countries.
I'd like to believe that the people that learn how to drive on those clutches will want to get back and learn how to drive.
But, you know, I'll say this. With the engine computers that we have today and fuel injection, if you just ease up the clutch slowly, without even putting your foot on the gas, mm-hmm. with a manual transmission car, today's cars will not stall.
Mm-hmm.
It will get... Now, not if you're going up a steep hill, but if you're just on a flat piece of pavement and you just ease up the clutch mm-hmm. slowly... The car will not stall in just about any modern-day car. So it's easier to learn. But like I said, this just makes it a no-brainer. Anybody can, you know, be very bad at coordinating a clutch and gas pedal and still come off like they really know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's actually my first lesson whenever I teach somebody how to drive a manual is just flat surface and ease off as slowly as possible so that they gain that trust in the fact that it's not going to stall on them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Let's see. We're probably towards the end here. What else? Rick in Laguna Niguel says, Ward's Auto says, no replacement for the Dodge Avenger. Are they expecting the customer to buy the Dart instead? Or what's going to happen?
You know, that's really interesting because the Ward's article that I believe the reader is mentioning is also talked about the Grand Caravan going away. And in exchange, it's just going to be the Town and Country. And we're watching a lot of these nameplates drop away from Dodge. And it's the volume brand for Chrysler, far and away. But, you know, you saw the Viper move to SRT. You saw all the trucks move out of Dodge into Ram. You know, what's going on there? I mean, are we looking at the eventual phase out now that we're looking
at Fiat? Well, I don't think so, because you said the key thing. The Dodge brand outsells every other brand at Chrysler and by a big margin.
Yeah.
So, Sergio talked about this 3 years ago, that they didn't like having too many vans that were essentially the same van, just different names. So my guess is Chrysler is going to have the big town and country, and you're going to see some sort of Fiat-based MPV come in for Dodge.
Well, and that's the other interesting thing is that they've confirmed at the same plant in Windsor that there's going to be a Pacifica-like vehicle, but it's going to carry a Chrysler name again.
Yeah.
And you've got the talk about the Barracuda, and that's not, you know, that's not going to be a Dodge. It's, and I don't mean to get all conspiratorial on people. I mean, it would be a really strange move to walk away from your number one volume brand. But it's interesting because we're not really hearing about any new Dodge-branded vehicles coming out.
Yeah. I just think Dodge is at the bottom of its product cycle right now. I can't believe that they're going to kill off the best-selling brand in the
country. Yeah, it would be a very, very odd move.
Yeah, I don't see that happening. Anyway, good show. I think we ought to wrap this up.
Thanks, but, Dan. Thanks.
Yeah, pleasure.
Great having you in here. The interesting
update.
Stuff. Really interesting.
Wait. Glad of 54 and a half miles per gallon out there. We showed how to do that.
A phone call just came in.
Oh, we just got a phone question. As long as they are calling in, let's go to that.
Hey, John. This is Vikas from Detroit. I have a question for Mr. Ranga. I just want to know, when can we get these engines in a regular, normal car? Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I would say that at this point it's going to depend heavily on the customers that we line up. The first one, so I don't want to be evasive. In our press release with Jean Ding, their interest is the end of 14 for a production engine. It will not be in a car. It's likely to be in a genset sort of application, then off-road and so forth. Now, that would be that customer's flow. So when do you see it in a car or a truck? I don't know. It might be a 2016 type of thing. It'll depend, again, who's the next customer and what's their intention. You know, one customer we've been talking to is interested in gasoline. So, you know, that would probably be for a you know, and they're an OEM, so they would look to that. Depending on where range extenders go, they might be looking at that because range extenders they're too heavy, they cost too much, and they have they use up a lot of space because of motors, batteries, and all that. So what you want is a small engine in there. So
I never thought of that. Could be ideal for a range extender.
Ideal for that. And actually, GM came, you know, talked to us about what would this look like in different range extender applications, because they all have the same sort of issues on cost and so forth. So it'll depend heavily on cars, because our approach to someone that makes engines is we don't think General Motors is going to buy engines from Eco Motors. You know, they might buy special purpose things like, you know, Chrysler bought Cummins diesels and stuff like that. But when the volumes get to something, they, you know, Motor is their middle name, so they're going to do it. We're prepared to license the architecture, work with them, and make a, you know, a GM or a Honda OPOC, so to speak. If you're a buyer of engines, marine, aerospace, gen sets, off-road, quite a few are purchased engines, and some commercial vehicles. Not everybody is totally integrated there. Those would be things that would buy engines. So there's not a lot of passenger car guys out there, the volume guys, that would buy any, you know, buy engines. So those we would look to. And then you run on their clock speed, so to speak.
But still, if you're saying in production for a gen set the end of next year, 16 or so, maybe a car, that, you know, that's the blink of an eye in automotive terms.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I'm enthusiastic because, you know, at the Automotive News World Congress, they asked a few of us to come down and talk about 54 and a half miles per gallon. And so I took the highest fuel economy production car I could find, which I think is the 2013 Nissan Altima, 31 mile per gallon all in. And now this is simulated, so this is not something you can get the keys. So we said, okay, let's do a dual mod, OPOC. The rules are it has to perform better than the Nissan Altima is from a 0 to 60 and all those things, so it's got to have about 200 horsepower. You can't weigh more than that, so ours weighs a little less, obviously. And we want to use dual modules, so we put in two what we would call EM65, 65 millimeter bores, 100 horsepower each, so we had 200 horsepower on tap. And we went through our simulation, which looks at road load, what the Nissan road load is, all that stuff, and what advantages we would bring to that. And we came in at 56.5 miles per gallon combined. No credits, and no solar roofs for a credit, no electric car 2-for-1 credits. Because in the 54.5, there's about 10 miles per gallon of credits, right? That gets no fuel economy for the consumer. It's just allows you as an OE to get it. So we wanted to demonstrate how can you really hit 54. I'm glad we beat it, 56.5. And we just let it come out. I said, okay, we'll just let it come out where it was. And so that I was enthusiastic about that. And that's gasoline. So you could add on whatever diesel would be. We didn't do the diesel simulation, but it would be some percentage higher than that. Obviously, you get a bump in the fuel alone, and diesel would be a little bit better, but I would expect
diesel. Hey, just occurred to me, what about running it on natural gas or propane?
Yeah, the engine would love natural gas. I mean, the compression ratio and those sort of things. So we've been asked by one commercial vehicle guy about natural gas. A lot of gensets run on natural gas because it's a great idea. So we'd love natural gas. But again, we want to use whatever after treatment, guys that use natural gases and whatever tanks, don't want to get involved in all that stuff. So
right.
Natural gas still has all the issues that, you know, you got to have a refueling infrastructure and all that stuff. But ours would still get more efficiency than a four-stroke natural gas engine. It would like it because, you know, you can run your compression ratios up a little higher. We don't have a head gasket to blow. So ours are in there, so we like higher pressures, so to speak.
Cool stuff.
So we like future stuff. Running hydrogen, you wouldn't have any emissions at all. So somebody can afford to buy the hydrogen.
Right. Well, again, Don,
okay.
Thanks so much for coming on. And we're going to have you back at some point,
okay.
Too, when we can drive these.
Yes,
things.
Right. We always think about, should we do a demonstrator model? And we've shied away from it. A, it's expensive to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I was head of advanced engineering at GM, I never believed those supplier models and prototypes they brought in anyway. I always thought there was a trick. So I think we'll hold off on that for a while. But it would be always good to throw you the keys and go for a ride in a dual mod.
Awesome. So. Someday.
Okay, someday.
Someday.
All right. All right.
Chris Pocker,
thanks
so much for coming on, man. Great having
always
you, too.
Always great to be here.
Peter, always good being with you.
Good to be with you.
We want to thank everybody who's tuned in tonight. By the way, you know, remember the podcast is at the iTunes store tomorrow. Just look for Autoline After Hours. Check us out on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/AutolineNetwork. You can send us tweets at Twitter. We're at twitter.com/Autoline. Check out Peter's stuff at autoextremist.com. Follow him at Twitter at twitter.com/PeterDeLorenzo. And, of course, you can see all of Chris's stuff on Autoblog.
It's autoblog.com.
So thanks for tuning in, and join us again here next week.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.